Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, a maritime saga from the 19th century. The story of the American whale ship, the Mentor, which wrecked in 1832 on a remote reef in the Western Pacific Ocean. The surviving crew faced many challenges, including the uncertainty of contact with the indigenous people of Palau. Eric J. Dolan is the author of The Wreck of the Mentor, a true story of death, despair, and deliverance in the age of sail. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Always have a page turner here. And how did you come across this story of the Mentor?
Well, as you remember, you interviewed me about Leviathan, the history of whaling in American history a long time ago. When I was working on that book around 2006, 2007, I ran across the story of the Mentor, since the Mentor is a whale ship that left from New Bedford, but it didn't make it into the narrative of Leviathan. But then if you fast forward to 2024, when I wrote a book called Left for Dead, which is about five men who were intentionally marooned on the Falkland Islands during the War of 1812, there are some parallels between that and the story of the Mentor. There were people, you know, left on an island in the Falklands. It was uninhabited, but they had to deal with severe privation, many years of isolation before being rescued. So it brought back to my mind the story of the Mentor, and I needed a topic for a new book. So I took a deep dive and I started reading everything I could about the wreck of the Mentor, and I was hooked, and luckily my publisher was too.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. So this is this was a whaling ship with a crew of 22, and this was in the heyday of whaling. So set the scene of the time period this is happening.
Right, yeah, this is right in the heart of the golden age of whaling. It'd been a few years since New Bedford outstripped Nantucket as the number one whaling port in the United States. The year that the Mentor left in 1831, nearly 700 voyages left from New Bedford. It was really an amazing time when American whale ships were literally traveling the seven seas looking for all sorts of whales. Now, the Mentor was mainly interested in sperm whales, which are the most valuable whales of all because the oil that came from their blubber, and more importantly, from the spermaceti organ in their head, was among the brightest burning and least smoky whale oil there was. And spermaceti oil was especially valuable for making spermaceti candles and also illuminating all the lighthouses that were cropping up along the American coast. So the Mentor was part of a much larger American presence in whaling. And this is already at a time when New Bedford was literally lighting the world.
Tell us a little bit more about the ship herself and the captain.
Built in 1807, it was originally just a merchant vessel. It's about 84 feet long, about 28 feet wide, fairly deep draft. It was converted into a whale ship in the late 1820s, the year before the Mentor went out with Captain Edward Barnard. He actually led up another voyage, whaling voyage, on the Mentor. That was a fairly greasy voyage. They came back with a significant number of barrels of whale oil. So it was a well-established, by that point, it was a pretty established whaling ship. They had to modify the merchant ship. They had to add davits on the side so they could hang the whale boats off the side. And those are the boats that were used to go out and attack the whales. Edward Barnard was originally a Nantucketer. He transplanted to New Bedford, as did much of the whaling industry at this time during the early parts of the Golden Age. And he was about 31 years old when he went out. They referred to him as the old man, although he wasn't that old by standards of captains of the day. He had a decent reputation. And one of the ways that I was able to divine that he did is that in the previous voyage, he had a crew that went with him. And for this voyage, I think it was four or five of the men captain, you were not eager to sign on again for another voyage with the same individual. So he had a good reputation as a mariner. He had just recently gotten married. The amazing thing reading about these stories about whalemen at the time, not just the 1800s, but in the 1700s, is how much time they spent away from their families. During the golden age of whaling, whaling voyages could easily last 3 or 4 years. And when these men came back, they would often meet daughters or sons that they had never seen before. And it's just amazing. And the women held down the fort at home. And amazing, even more amazing to me is that the men came back. They only spent a couple of months sometimes with their family before they went out again to provide the money that their family needed to survive.
All right, so May 18th, 1832, the Mentor runs into some trouble, some big trouble.
Right. Ed Barnard thought that he was out in open water. They're heading in the Pacific Ocean, which was teeming with sperm whales. A storm rolled in. He was unable to use celestial navigation, and he thought he had plenty of sea room, but a little bit after midnight, they crash into a reef off of the archipelago of Palau, the northern reaches of Palau. Palau is basically an archipelago of 340 islands. Many of them are small. If you added up all the islands in Palau, it'd only equal New Orleans in size. But the Mentor crashed, and let's go on to see what happened next.
Yeah. Now you write, one can't help but wonder how the story of the Mentor might have unfolded differently had it sailed just a few miles farther to the north on that stormy night. It would have missed Palau entirely and might have made it safely all the way to Guam, the intended destination. But this is a common tale in history. Small changes in one direction or another, or different decisions made by key individuals, can have major ramifications. That is really so fascinating, not just in this story, but in history in general, right? You go, oh, if only.
Oh, absolutely. Every single book I've written has stories in it which, if something had happened a little bit differently, if a different decision had been made, if timing was different, the entire story would have played out differently. And I think most famously in my book about privateering, Rebels at Sea, you look at George Washington and us winning the American Revolution. There were so many points during that conflict where if things had gone slightly in a different direction, the outcome might have been different.
Yeah. In the author's note, you mentioned that you did rely a lot on the written accounts, which would be the perspective of Westerners. Oral traditions, as you note, are critical to understanding history, but not so easy to come by. That's the difficult part as a historian, right? Is you want to get everybody's point of view, but it can be really tough.
Oh, no, it's absolutely incredibly difficult. Anybody writing history in the 1800s, 1700s, 1600s that involve Western countries such as the United States or the American colonies. Yes, most of the accounts that are left are by those who have a written history, or sometimes, as people say, by the winners in history. And you have to tease out of the accounts that you have as much information about the people that they were interacting with. But fortunately, there are some oral histories that you can rely on, and there are multiple perspectives in the case of the Mentor of different people that were involved that give their take. And since those agree to a large extent, and I don't think are unfair to the native populations, I was able to, reflect those in the book. But I also used Palauan sources, some books that are written by Palauans in Palau to teach their own history. There are some oral histories that I was able to find that either relate to Palauan history in general or this event in particular. But as an author or as a historian, you have one of two choices. You either say, I can't write any history back then because we don't have the legitimate voices of those who are half of the story. You could say that for the Indians that were that we interacted with as the United States swept over the continent. They didn't have a lot of written history. There are some oral histories, but we would love to have more of their perspective. The same for my pirate book. We would love to have more of the perspective of the pirates as opposed to the people that were preyed upon. And with the Mentor, I would absolutely love to be able to go back and watch the proceedings. But if you decide that you can't write the book, then that's the end of it. But if you decide that you're going to do the best with the materials you have, which is the approach that I always take, I think you get a book like The Mentor, which I think gives both sides in the story a fair shake.
Yeah. Tell us more about Palau at the time. You mentioned, the islands, but this is a pretty remote place. It's not very well traveled, right?
Yeah. And one thing I've realized in talking to some people about the book is that a lot of Americans don't know Palau at all or haven't heard of it. It's this archipelago. It's about 500 miles to the east of the southern tip of the Philippines. It's part of Micronesia, which means small islands. So it is very remote and it was off the normal trade routes. So they didn't have a lot of interactions with Westerners before the mentor came along. But it's a very rich and vibrant culture, goes back thousands of years, as is the case for many native cultures in the Pacific Islands. We are not 100% sure how the first Palauans reached this group of islands, but clearly they did so in canoes or rafts, and they had a very active canoe society. They had multiple types of canoes. They were engaged in fishing. It was a matrilineal society where women chose the leaders. The men went out and fought and fished. It's just a fascinating culture, and there was also a heavily tattooed culture, and that plays a role in the book.
Right. So the we have the storm, the mentor wrecks, half the crew survive. We have 22 people on board, 11 people don't survive that. Talk about that, what happens in the storm.
Right. When a ship is at sea, the captain is the ultimate authority on board. But the minute that the ship crashes, his authority sort of disappears. Now, you could still defer to him because he was very knowledgeable and he was a good leader up to that point. But in the aftermath of the crash, when they realized that the mentor was not going to ever refloat and sail away, the first mate decided that his best bet was to get in one of the whaleboats, and nine men chose to accompany him. They lowered the whaleboat into the water and they were never seen again. And they actually drowned probably within hundreds of yards of the wreck when the whaleboat overturned and pitched them into the water. Then the captain, Edward Barnard, decided, you know, I think I'll leave this wreck. It might disintegrate before dawn. So he and three other people got into another whaleboat. Edward Barnard, looking to his own survival, he tied a rope around his waist. And the other end was tied off on the ship itself, so that if the whaleboat were to overturn after it left the ship, he could be pulled back to safety. Well, the whaleboat never made it off of the ship because as it was being lowered, a wave crashed into the mentor, smashed the whaleboat to smithereens, and sent the men into the darkness. One of them drowned very soon thereafter. Two of them, one of them was able to grab the rigging immediately before head falling into the water. He got back on board. Another one was a good swimmer, which was very unusual for mariners of the day. And he was able to scamper back up onto the mentor's deck. And then the rope saved Edward Barnard's life because he was probably drawn out to about 100 yards away from the ship. And the men on board were pulling him back in, and they could hear him shrieking, save me, or some words to those effect. And finally, they got him back on board. He was a little worse for wear, but he was not seriously injured. And then they had to await the dawn to see what their next step would be.
Yeah. Whenever I'm reading books like this, it's like I try to imagine what it must be like in that moment, right? Here you are, you know your ship is wrecked. It's, you know, you're in this storm, you're hanging on for dear life. And you have no idea what's in store. So it's just before sunrise, and a large canoe is approaching. Captain Barnard and his men, obviously concerned, they're wondering, hey, is this going to be friendly or not so friendly? They have no idea what's in store for them.
Yeah. Well, just to set the stage a little bit more, they actually left the boat, the mentor, on their last whaleboat, and they went to this small cay or island. That's where they were greeted by this canoe of very threatening-looking individuals, completely naked men with clubs and spears and knives. Basically, they were coming there because they had seen evidence of the wreck. They'd seen the wreck. They knew that there were people on this little island. And the Palauans had an interaction with the British bark back in 1783. And not to go into that in any great detail, but part of the result of that crash and the Palauans helping the British build a ship for them to escape on is that the Palauans were given guns and ammunition, not only at that point, but later with another ship that came by. So these Palauans, which were in a different village from where the British bark had crashed, they knew about the value of guns, how powerful they were. And what they were doing is they wanted to go to the wreck to find any muskets that might be on board. So they pleaded with the men of the Mentor to follow them, and they did get into their whaleboat. They didn't go back. They went back to the wreck, but then they started pulling away, and they thought they were going to be taken to the village. But very soon thereafter, the Palauans in the canoe started attacking the whalemen. So Barnard decided to use the natives' avidity against them. He knew that they were very interested in their clothes and anything they had on board. So he had his men throw over one piece of clothes at a time, as far away as they could, as they were pulling away. And the canoe would go grab the piece of clothes, then continue the pursuit. They did this so often, and they got so far away from Kayengal, the island where these Palauans came from, that the Palauans turned around. They gave up. And now the men of the Mentor on this whaleboat, which was leaking at a prodigious rate, had to face the sea for a couple of days until they landed on another island and then had other interactions with the locals.
Tell us about this other island.
Well, the other island was larger, and they were there for a little while, and then a man and a boy came up in a canoe. They had a brief interaction. The man in the canoe was sort of imploring them to follow. And they got into there because they thought, oh, we're going to be taken to another village. So they got into their whaleboat. And before they made it around the promontory, a whole fleet of canoes was approaching. Excuse me. And one of the canoes came up to the whaleboat very quickly, like at ramming speed, but at the last moment with very good paddle work, it stopped right next to the whaleboat. The leader of that canoe jumped onto the whaleboat, tapped Barnard on the head, sort of as a show of dominance. And then ultimately they were taken to the village of Ngarshalang, which was different from Kayengal. So they were taken to the village. At first, the villagers were very agitated because they thought that they might be British, and they had a tough time communicating. And the reason they wanted to know if they were British is because that British bark that had crashed in 1783 gave arms and ammunition to the village of Koror, which was to the south of Ngarshalang. And Koror used the arms and ammunition to become the supreme power, the most powerful village in Palau. And one of the villages they vanquished was Ngarshalang. So the Ngarshalangese had hatred in their heart for the British, who had armed their enemies, so to speak. So they wanted to find out if these Americans were British. Barnard was able to convince them somehow that they weren't British, but they're American. They had no idea what America was, but the fact that they weren't British lowered the temperature of the animosity. And then finally, the local priestess said that the men should be welcomed. But what happened that was so fortuitous at this moment is that a guy named Charlie, a British sailor who had crashed, or not crashed, but he had jumped ship essentially in the early 1800s, and he had become a beachcomber, which was a term that they used for Westerners who would land on Pacific islands in one way or another. Either they were banished, they escaped, maybe they wrecked there, and they decided to become part of the local native culture. Well, old Charlie, as they called him, could speak English and Palauan. He was a lower level chief and he had a Palauan wife. So it was really fortuitous for the Americans because old Charlie acted as an interpreter. Right. So all of a sudden they could speak very freely with the Palauans. And the Palauans said, you know what? We'll help you build a ship to leave and go back to the Spice Islands so you could ultimately get home. However, the British helped Koror with guns and ammunition. You are going to help us. You are going to bring back 200 guns, muskets, ammunition, flint, and balls. And to make sure that you do that, three of your men are going to stay here in Ngarshalang as hostages until you return. So that's the deal that's struck. They have no luck building a boat out of the remains of the Mentor
left,
and other stuff. So they build a grand canoe for the men. And ultimately, the men of the whaleboat, the men of the Mentor, leave on this grand canoe and their whaleboat. But it's important. This is something you read about in the book. Koror finds out about these Americans that are there. So Koror is threatening in Garshalong again, give us those Americans. And the reason they want the Americans is not because they like America. They want to help. They want to get the guns
They
that
want
they
more
know these
guns.
Westerners can provide.
Yeah. We're talking with Eric J. Dolan. He's the author of The Wreck of the Mentor, a true story of death, despair, and deliverance in the age of sail. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Eric J. Dolan, the author of The Wreck of the Mentor, a true story of death, despair, and deliverance in the age of sail. So this old Charlie and the beachcombers, I thought that was kind of interesting because he's not the only. There are other beachcombers, and it's sort of interesting, this existence that they have.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can go back to the 1600s, and that's when the first that we know of beachcombers from the West are in the Pacific and different places around the world, actually. There are probably hundreds, maybe even 1,000 in the Pacific in the 1830s. I mean, Herman Melville was a beachcomber for a while when he left the whale ship Acushnet, and he used his experience in Pompeii as the sort of grist for some of his later novels. So yes, there were a lot of these beachcombers. In fact, in Palau at the time that old Charlie was there, there were two or three other beachcombers in Koror. So it is a fascinating little piece of history. It's like almost like an expatriate community.
Right.
And most of them decided to become, in effect, become natives because they liked what they were experiencing. A couple of them, you know, became troublemakers. One of them, a guy named David Whippy, a former, he was a biche de mer, a sea cucumber. He was on a vessel getting sea cucumbers. His ship failed to come back and pick him up in Fiji. And he stayed there for many years, fathered children, and became an important ambassador between the island and any Western ships that came by. So it is a fascinating little story within the story of these beachcombers.
And not always to be trusted, right? Sometimes they're interpreting well, and sometimes they're interpreting for their own, benefit, right?
Yeah, old Charlie is guilty of that later on in the
definitely.
Book. Yes, they are. Some of them are quite duplicitous.
Yeah.
And with great power comes great responsibility, but some of them are very irresponsible.
Right. So Captain Barnard finds himself, though, in this kind of a bit of a pickle, right? He's got these natives who are going to build him this canoe. You got the Koror who are like, oh, no, we want the Americans. And he's sort of torn. He's trying to appease both sides, right?
Right. Yeah, and the problem was he was in Garshalong. The Kororese sent chiefs and other people, including a beachcomber, to Garshalong to lure Barnard away, saying, if you come to Koror, we'll help you, and we have some navigational equipment that could be quite valuable in your trip to the Spice Islands. Barnard wants to go because the Garshalongese hadn't done something for a couple of weeks or months. And then when they started to try to build the ship, it wasn't going that well. But he decided in the end that he wasn't his own master. He and his men were physically in Garshalong. And to leave would have potentially caused great harm to them and might have launched a war between Garshalong and Koror. So he was in a bind. If it was just up to him, he would have left and gone to Koror. And because he thought that was a better prospect of getting back home.
Yeah. So they get this canoe and they set out, but they don't make their destination.
No, not at all. The canoe, even though the canoe is made out of a huge breadfruit tree, even though the Garshalongese and Palauans in general are renowned for their canoe building skills and canoe paddling skills, this canoe was not a feather in their cap. As Horace Holden, one of the greenhands on board, noted, it sort of bobbed around like a saw log. And soon after they left, it tipped over and swamped, and they couldn't get the water out of it. So they ultimately discarded this huge canoe. The problem is, when it swamped and tipped over, they lost a lot of their food and water, and all of the men, including, the mentor's men, it was eight of them, but it was also three Garshalongese who were sent along to learn about the larger world. So all these men had to now cram into the whaleboat. They were out in the open ocean under the blistering sun with very little water, very little food, on the edge of starvation for nearly 15 or 16 days. And then they suddenly saw an island, a very small island. Edward Barnard knew that it wasn't the Spice Islands. He didn't know what it was, but before he could get his bearings, a number of canoes were racing out to meet them.
And they were not so friendly.
They were not friendly at all. In fact, the first thing they did is they started destroying the whaleboat after pitching out all of its inhabitants, all the people on the whaleboat, because they wanted the wood and, more importantly, the iron nails that were holding together the planks of wood. So they basically destroyed the whaleboat down to its the base of it. It was still floating. And that the men, the Angarshalangese and the men of the Mentor, would swim from canoe to canoe, pleading to be taken on board, only to be hit in the head and rebuffed. Finally, the Tobians, because this was the island of Toby, which is part of Palau today, but wasn't back then. They even spoke a different language, a small island, 1 mile by a half mile wide. The Tobians finally consented and pulled the whalemen and the Angarshalangese onto their canoes and then towed the remains of the whaleboat to shore.
And one of the things about this island of Toby, it was interesting just how different the islands as far as resources would go, right? Toby doesn't have the same kind of resources when it comes to food.
Oh, absolutely. Well, part of it is because of scale. And Garshalong was on a very large island, the largest island in Palau. So there were a lot of resources there. Karor was also on a much larger island than Toby is. Toby was only a mile long and a half mile wide. So beyond coconuts, taro roots, and fishing, they really didn't have a lot. And there were a number of reasons during the time that the Americans were there that there was severe privation. There were about 400 people on this little island, a mile long by a half mile wide. And they had a tough time surviving themselves. And now they had these additional men in their midst.
Yeah. And so the men are sort of split up. They, I forgot what you called them. They were assigned to some.
I mean, well, some people read the book. The term used by some of the people who came back and wrote about their time there is they sort of were enslaved or slaves, but it wasn't quite that. They sort of were doled out to individual Tobians, and those Tobians became their overseers for the time that they were there. They were part of their family in a sense, but a very low level part. They weren't treated like family. Yeah. That's for sure.
So the forced work, and as we said earlier, this is kind of a remote area. There's not really a lot of opportunity to escape.
No, not at all. This is, I mean, Palau in general is way off the beaten path. And Toby is so small that most ships would miss it. There were only a few interactions in the hundreds of years preceding the Men of the Mentor's arrival where Tobians actually saw a Western ship and occasionally did some trades with them. But they were far less familiar with the West than the Palauans had been. So it's really a remote place.
Yeah. Talk a little about the differences. Like, you know, many of these people, they had not seen white people before, right? And most of these, inhabitants were naked. Some were not. But talk about a little bit about the different cultures, the experience of seeing each other.
Yeah. Well, both in Palau and on Toby, the men were generally naked. The women often wore skirts made out of the fronds of coconut trees or other plants that were available. They did adorn themselves with what we would call jewelry, but it was sort of natural jewelry. There were bracelets made out of dugongs, like a manatee's vertebrae, and there were other things. There were hawksbill turtle shells that were used and carved into bits of jewelry. Both in Toby and in Palau, the men and women were heavily tattooed. They were particularly fond of their hair, and they used to grease their hair with coconut oil. And they were into, fishing, and there was farming. that took place at both places. But yes, even though there had been interactions with the West, it was very few and far between. So the natives on Toby and in Palau were fascinated by these Western visitors, but even more so on Toby, because their interactions with Western ships had been very, very few, spread over 100 or 150 years. So they really looked at the whiteness of the skin of the whalemen, and in some cases touched them, and also their hairiness, because the Tobians plucked their body hair, everything minus their head. It was just part of their local culture. So yes, these were very odd human beings that had suddenly arrived on their islands. And by the same token, the whalemen, it was different in Palau than it was in Toby. In Toby, when the whalemen arrived there first, they were sort of disgusted by the locals. They didn't know a lot about Palau, but they felt they were just savages and brutes. After being there for a number of months, their opinion changed quite dramatically, and they, while not viewing them as friends, they viewed them as people who had been very kind to them, supportive, and they weren't viewed so despicably by the Americans. But in Toby, they never changed their view of the Tobians. They thought that they were the rudest savages they had ever seen. They didn't understand their culture, even though that they learned the local language, because some of the Americans were there for years. It was a much more condescending view of a native culture than they had of the Palauans they had encountered before. But this is very common during this time. Westerners in general had a condescending, arrogant view of, condescending towards islanders that they encountered, and arrogant in the sense of how they viewed themselves and their civilization, when in reality, they all were civilized. They just had different stages of civilization or levels, and they had different resources available to them. For example, Palauans and Tobians were unfamiliar with iron before the Westerners arrived, and certainly with guns. And unfortunately, as happened in so many Pacific islands, the introduction of guns and ammunition really changed the nature of the culture, and often ended in a lot of bloodshed.
We're talking with Eric J. Dolan. His new book is The Wreck of the Mentor, a true story of death, despair, and deliverance in the age of sail. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Eric J. Dolan about his new book, The Wreck of the Mentor, a true story of death, despair, and deliverance in the age of sail. So Captain Barnard, he actually escapes. He gets away, but that doesn't bode well for those left behind.
No, a couple of months after they arrive in Toby, a ship comes by, the Sabina, which was on its way to Calcutta, and it slowed down and it was going to trade with the Tobians. The American whalemen and the Angarshalangis tried to get onto the canoes that were going out to trade with the Sabina, but they were viciously beaten back by the Tobians. However, Barnard and one other whaleman were able to get on a canoe after continuous trying. They went out. Barnard yelled to Captain Soames on the Sabina, speaking in English. And pretty soon, in pretty short order, Barnard was on board the ship, and he pleaded with Soames to give the Tobians a good quantity of iron in exchange for getting the other whalemen onto the Sabina. They gave out some iron, the other whalemen got onto the Sabina, and now Barnard wanted Soames to go to Toby and get everybody else, all the other whalemen and the Angarshalangis who were there. Soames was too concerned about being overwhelmed by the native population, the warriors, because he didn't have a large crew. He actually gave a couple of explanations as to why he wouldn't go to retrieve the rest, but he didn't. And off the Sabina sails. And Barnard, in one of his later accounts, he said that he felt that the amount of iron that had been given to the Tobians in exchange for releasing him and the other whalemen should have been sufficient, should have been enough to make the Tobians happy, in effect, Well, it was anything but. They thought that the Westerners were too stingy. So when the Tobians got back to their island, they took out their frustrations on the remaining whalemen and the N'Garshalangyis who were there, treating them even worse than before.
Yeah, it was awful. And poor Horace Holden, boy, did he go through a lot. And
Yes.
that talk about that, they tattooed him, right? Talk about that tattoo process. I was like, oh my gosh, this guy's, barely alive as it is, and now they're tattooing him.
Yeah, they tattooed them after they had been there for a little bit more than, I think it was almost a year at that time. So these men, the remaining whalemen, and there were fewer of them because they started dying, they were very weak, skeletal-like. And since it appeared that they were going to be permanent residents of Toby, the locals decided they needed to look more like the Tobians. So not only did they force the whalemen to pluck body hair from their everything, not including their head, they also forcibly tattooed them in the arms and chest. And the process was to take a bird's bone or a fish bone that has a point like a needle. They had taro root dye from the taro plant, which was a purplish in color. And they would treat the skin with local ointment, but it wasn't like Novocaine, no, it wasn't a deadening ointment. And then they would trace out the tattoo, and then along would come the needle in effect, and it would be pounded into the skin with a 2-foot-long block of wood. And according to the descriptions, sometimes that needle would go all the way through to hit the bone. So it was very painful. Screaming while being tattooed, and the Tobians would sing to drown out the screaming while he was being tattooed. It happened over 3 days, and this was only the chest and the arms. They could have gone to other parts of the body, but they didn't. And he said that his chest and arms were like an open sore for many days thereafter, and the pain was intense. And the fascinating thing is, at one point, the Tobians wanted to tattoo the men's faces, because Tobians had tattoos on their faces as well. Well, the whalemen just went bananas, and they basically said, "We would rather die than have our faces tattooed. And if you tattoo us on the face, our God will bring down his wrath upon you." And this was enough to keep the Tobians from tattooing the whalemen's faces.
Right. Captain Barnard hasn't forgotten, right? And eventually we get the Vincennes sent out to rescue Americans on various Pacific islands, either the beachcombers or those that are held against their will.
Right. Barnard on the way back, he talks to the captain of the USS Boxer on the way back, a American warship, saying you need to go to Palau and Toby and rescue the Americans who are still there. And then when he gets back to the United States, he writes a letter to Levi Woodbury, the Secretary of the Navy, arguing the same. Ultimately, yes, the USS Vincennes, a formidable warship, is sent to retrieve not only the Americans on Palau and Toby, and also return any N'Garshalangyis who are on Toby back to their village of N'Garshalang, but also the Vincennes is in the Pacific to gather up any other beachcombers that they could find on various islands. And then, well,
Yeah. Oh, see,
I'll let you ask the next question.
this is why. I mean, I honestly didn't think Holden was going to make it, right? But he does.
Yeah.
And in fact, fascinatingly, he lives a long life.
Oh, yeah. No, well, Holden was able to escape along with another whaleman years later when the Britannia, a British ship, comes by and they're able to get on board. And it's a fascinating story of how they're able to get on board and how Holden and the captain of the Britannia thank the Tobians. So you have to read the book to find out about that. But so yes, the so he escape he escapes. He kind of gets back to the United States and he writes a memoir, which is one of the main sources I used in writing my book. And it was a very successful book at the time, went through numerous printings and reprintings. And he lives till he's 94 years old. And he dies in 1904. And his story, it sort of crops up every couple of decades. They write stories about him. But right when he was approaching his 93rd, 92nd year, a number of stories came out about him, and the story of the mentor was resuscitated. But then it sort of died after that. It came to life in the 1950s in a fictionalized account of the wreck of the mentor. And then in the late 70s, 1970s, Barnard's manuscript, which has been hidden, misfiled, and ignored in the vaults of a museum, was rediscovered. It had never been published. And then you come to my story. And I was able to use all those accounts to tell my story. But Holden was a fascinating character, not only because I would love to thank him for writing that memoir, which was critical to writing my book, but he seemed to be a very sensible individual. He was very observant. And he lived a fascinating life. He went to Hawaii, he became involved in sericulture or silk manufacturing, pineapples. Then he went to Oregon. He was one of the first settlers in Oregon, the Oregon Territory. He had a farm, he had multiple children. But one thing he didn't do was show his tattoos to anybody but his family and one or two other reporters that came calling. So I thought that was fascinating because there were other men who came back from the Pacific who were heavily tattooed and basically became circus performers.
So in the end, of the 22 who were aboard the Mentor, seven made it back. And it was sort of a bit of a sad story. And I'm the name is escaping me, but the one from Nantucket where the dad was really hopeful. He was going to get some information about his son, and his son happened to be one that got on that first whaleboat and was never seen again.
Right. He was the first mate, Colesworthy. And what happened is when Bar when Holden when he came back, he wrote the book, and he went to Nantucket and he met with Colesworthy's dad. No, this is Barnard. Sorry, now I'm getting confused. God, see, I have to read my own book to figure out what's going on. Barnard, when he came back, he went to Nantucket and he met with Colesworthy's dad. And he said that, according to Colesworthy, that his son had gotten away in that whaleboat and it was fine water. He wasn't overturned, there wasn't a wreck, and he might very well be on another island someplace. And this gave Colesworthy's father hope. But then when Holden came back and wrote his book and went to Nantucket and spoke to Colesworthy's dad, he basically put to rest that hope that the father had that his son might still be alive in the Pacific, because Holden told him, no, unfortunately, the whaleboat overturned. The men were never seen again. There's no way they survived.
And I think it was Holden who said, in some ways, that might have been the better way to go, right?
Holden, in looking over his history in Palau and Toby, which spanned almost 4 years, there was such privation. It was such a brutal existence that, yes, he mused in his book that it might have been better had I been in that first whaleboat and died instantly rather than having to deal with 4 years of suffering.
Amazing too that of the seven that came back, one of them went back out whaling. That you would even think
Oh,
about
yeah.
going back whaling after all of that.
Yeah, he went back out whaling. Well, Barnard went back out whaling and then captained a ship on Lake Erie, and which crashed, and he died in 1844. But these men, it seems amazing to us. Some of them didn't want to go whaling, but you see that story time and again. People that were on whaling voyages that weren't successful, or ones that came to grief, like the mentor, sometimes those men, because they didn't have other opportunities, or they were wedded to the sea, that was their livelihood, chose to get back on a ship and go out again.
Did you go visit the islands when you were doing your research?
I did not. I get asked this question all the time. If I had to go there to write the book I wanted to write, I would have gone there. I had accounts from the era of Palau, and those are what I relied on. I mean, I was asked the same question about Left 4 Dead and the Falkland Islands. I didn't visit there, but people who live on the Falkland Islands said I did a wonderful job of describing the islands, and I hope that the Palauans feel the same way. But I did send a copy of my book to the president of Palau about a week ago, so we'll see if he likes it. Maybe he'll invite me to come down. I wouldn't mind going there, but it wasn't on the top of my bucket list. I have, and again, the way I do it is if I have to go visit someplace because it will give me better information to write the book that I want to write, then I will do it gladly. But I really thought about it in this case, and there was nothing on Palau that I couldn't get from here that I needed to go there to get.
So when you look at the stories written from, Holden and Barnard and the different accounts, there's some differences. How do you take all those little nuances into effect? People remember things differently, right? So as a historian, how do you put all that together?
Well, that's absolutely true. You can have the same set of facts or a same occurrence, and if different people are watching it, they may come up with different interpretations. The only way you can do it is to take all of the sources together in context and try to figure out if there are clues that indicate that one might be a more reliable reporter than another person. Fortunately, in the case of the mentor, the two main accounts of the time on the islands, one of Barnard, one of Holden, those agreed in most instances. They didn't in all, and they covered some different time periods. So you just have to do your best. As my, I don't know, there's no other way to tell history, whether it's about the American Revolution, the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln. You're never going to have the complete story. There's always going to be another source that you wish you had. You have to do the best you have with the information you have. And I believe that I did that with this book.
Such a fascinating story, and obviously we didn't. You got to read the book to hear it all. I mean, there's a lot in that we didn't get to talk about, but I'm just thinking as you're going through this. The surprises that you must have come across in your research, like you think I've got a pretty good book here, and then you find these little nuggets that you go, "Wow!" So, what was the most surprising piece of evidence or fact that came to you that you were like, "Wow!"
This is going to sound like a cop out, but it was almost everything because, as you know, since I've been on the show many times before and you're familiar with my earlier books, I write books on very different topics. And when I start, I don't know much about it. So it's like getting a master's degree in a year and a half on a specific topic. So almost everything in this book just blew me away. But some of the accounts of the newspaper accounts when the men returned, I found particularly fascinating. Some of the accounts of Holden in his later years and how people reflected on his time on Palau, I found fascinating. Just learning about the Palauan culture, but more than that, learning or thinking, sort of you referenced this before, trying to put myself in the position of these whalemen in 1832, halfway around the world, no GPS, no cell phones, no nothing. You are out there on your own and you're trying your best to survive, and so many different obstacles are thrown up in your way. And I did think quite often, I said, what would I have done in that situation? And you like to think that the will to survive is strong enough to give you courage and keep moving forward. But in reality, you don't know until you're confronted with such dire circumstances. It was just a fascinating story for me to research and write from beginning to end.
Yeah, so true. All right. The book is The Wreck of the Mentor, A True Story of Death, Despair, and Deliverance in the Age of Sail. And we'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Eric J. Dolan, you're going to be at the Eldridge Public Library in Chatham on June 16th. And I know you have more events on your website. As always, thanks for being with us. Thanks for writing the book. It was fascinating.
Thanks for reading it. Thanks for having me on. It's been great.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.